Well, there you go.
We'd like to welcome you to another in the continuing ongoing interpreter sponsored gospel doctrine discussion scripture roundtables. That sure is, sometimes seems like a mouthful to put all those things in one sentence. But this is the 76th scripture roundtable put on by Interpreter, a Journal of Mormon Scripture. Today we're going to be continuing in our overviews of the Old Testament Gospel Doctrine Manuals lessons. Today is lesson 26, entitled King Solomon, Man of Wisdom, Man of Foolishness, which covers the intro into the first book of Kings, specifically about 1 Kings 1 through about chapter 11. Though the manual does jump around quite a bit and focuses on a number of stories because they have more applicability to our own understanding and our own lived discipleship than say other sections. We will cover some of those sections as those can also be of interest to students of the scriptures, as well as potentially, depending upon viewpoint, also impact how we go about teaching and discussing these writings in the Old Testament Hebrew Bible and what they mean for us. Our discussants today, my name is Andrew Smith. With me are Martin Tanner and Bruce Webster. So let's go ahead and get started, and maybe Bruce, you can give us some opening thoughts about Solomon and David.
Well, the First Kings actually starts with the death of David, or his actually it starts with the whole succession issue. David is old. He seems to be losing power and influence. There is question of succession. His son Adonijah, I don't know if I pronounced that correctly, is basically proclaiming himself king, and you get this political intrigue to get Solomon, get to David to declare Solomon his successor. That happens, and then you get David giving counsel to Solomon. Now, we've got here what is arguably sort of the golden age of the United Kingdom of Israel, and you have David and Solomon who really rule as kings in a way that Saul never did, and with at least on the surface a lot of power and success, and yet there is sort of an undertone there that which we'll get into in a little while that you have. You know, two stories of tragedy with these two kings, and they turn out not being quite as admirable as one would think, given their very prominent role in Israelite history.
So it's good to keep the context of what the historical record is trying to point us to, but it's also important to recognize that much of this material comes about was written down by scribes and historians well after the fact of what's going on. So we know of Solomon and David and their issues here, but the people who are putting together the record that we understand as the Old Testament are going to be a few generations later. And Martin, you wanted to talk a little bit about that and how the record came to us and what we want to learn from that.
I'd be happy to. Originally, based on scholarship, the books of Joshua, Judges, Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings were almost certainly composed as one large text, which was a history of the what's called the former prophets in early literature. And they were intended to be a history from Joshua's conquest of Palestine down to the time of the exile. The division of the books would have been, of course, necessary for convenience sake. It's easy for us to keep them in book form all tied together, but when you had them in scroll form, it would have just been much, much too large. To keep them in one large book, so they were no doubt divided up for those purposes. They were almost certainly composed somewhere around 622 BC as part of the Deuteronomistic, I butchered that one. Reform. The Deuteronomic code was discovered in the temple in Kings, in 2 Kings chapter 22 and 23, verses 1 through 20. It talks about the discovery during the time of King Josiah of the books, that the law that had been lost, or at least not consulted and forgotten. And so King Josiah shows great interest in those, and he reformed the religion of the Israelites, and that effort resulted in the Bible, or at least the early parts of the Bible, as we have it now in these early former prophets' books, which we now call the books of Joshua, Judges, Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings. We know that there are lost sources for 1 Kings. There are three that are mentioned in 1 Kings 11, verse 41, the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel. In 1 Kings 14, 19, it specifically references the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel. The reference I just gave, the 1 Kings 11:41, is the one to another source, the book of the Acts of Solomon. And there was a third source that's specifically referenced here in 1 Kings 14, verse 29. That's the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of the Kings of Judah. And all of these works are now lost. We know that these were probably compiled by some kind of official historian. There is an official historian or recorder that's mentioned at the time of David in 2 Samuel chapter 8, verse 16, and that tradition no doubt was continued on. We know that these books were very important because, frankly, we have them today. And so they must have been important because early Israel kept what was most important. And these were books that were not only written once, but in several different formats. And there's actually some overlap between 1 Kings and some of the other books that we even currently have in the Bible as part of Chronicles. So there's a short little background about the part of 1 Kings that we're talking about today dealing with Solomon.
Yeah, no, and just to add to that, it's important to note that first, you know, scholarly approaches are not necessarily all unified in that understanding. What Martin has pointed out is perhaps one of the majority opinions out there, originally put forward by Frank Moore Cross, that that this Deuteronomistic history was originally compiled pre-exile, largely, more than likely, with regard to the reform at the same time as the reforms of Josiah. But there are other scholars that put a different date on it, saying it must have been compiled after the exile, either in Babylon or after the return, even some put it that late. All of these theories are put forward in a way to deal with some of the issues that come up. And when you're reading through these passages, there are some specific ideas and things that are put up that seem to presuppose a post-exilic idea, you know, talking about the destruction of the temple and these kinds of ideas that from a scholarly, secular, academic point of view could not possibly have been known. And so they're trying to situate these things. Personally, you know, I having looked at a lot of literature and read up on some of these things, I'm much more comfortable and leaning towards an understanding that sees the original compilation of this history coming together during the time of Josiah, but then also admitting that after the exile, there were significant modifications and redactions put forward that changed and added to the original history and how these things are working. And you can see some of the aspects that come into this, particularly in the Deuteronomistic history as a whole, covering those four books that Martin mentioned. You see a lot of contradictions and viewpoints and understandings that are best understood as you have an original work that then is modified and changed to put things in a different position. And that becomes one of the more important ways of understanding what these books are trying to say, because you'll go from some chapters initially that hold David, for instance, in very high regard and position him as you know, established of God, but then you come to these chapters in 1 Kings, and suddenly David is old and somewhat decrepit, and there's a question of, you know, how impactful and effective he is as a king, and some negative characterizations, etc. And this, and so you have these contrasting viewpoints, and it makes sense to see them as coming at different points and different times. But perhaps for our purposes, one of the more important things to understand is that these things are definitely written with an agenda in mind. The person who is coming together to write, and then especially the people that come together and take these, like Martin mentioned, you have original sources that are being incorporated into this overarching history, and it's important to ask the question, why is this being written the way it is? We can look at these things, and we have, based on modern revelation and under understandings of the workings of God within the history of mankind, we have an understanding that these were real people, and that they did have many of these experiences. But also we have to ask, why did the historians write about them the way they did? And so we'll talk about a couple of these little things here specifically. Bruce, you want to talk about the darker side of this history, perhaps?
Well, yeah, and actually, before I get into that, an interesting follow-up to the comment on the date of composition and so on is that in the Book of Mormon, there's only a very limited number of references to this whole period covered by the Joshua, Judges, Samuel, Kings sequence of books. You basically have and interestingly, I think they're all pretty much centered with Nephi and Jacob. You have a passing reference, Nephi saying, you know, the Lord wouldn't have led Israel into Palestine if the people there had been righteous. You have some negative comments, and you have Nephi also saying, I'm building a temple after the pattern of the Temple of Solomon, though in Nephi's case, Nephi would have actually been familiar with the actual temple. So it's not clear how much he's relying on scriptural references there. And then as was discussed in a earlier roundtable a few weeks ago, you have rather negative comments by Jacob about David and Solomon with regards to their polygamy. And that suggests, I mean, if we are looking at a composition date of 622 or thereabouts B.C., that's just a few decades before the departure of Lehi and his party. And it's unclear what was actually on the brass plates to cover that period, post-Exodus, pre-exile, and how much more abbreviated that record may have been in what the Nephites brought with them, or Lehi and his family brought with them to the New World. Since we have, you know, a lot of characters for that period of time we have almost no mention of. Now, as per your comment, we've got this contrast. You know, one of the great contrasts, this is something Robert K. Thomas, who was former academic vice president at BYU when I was an undergraduate, pointed out in the talk. We have the Psalm 108, which has the last words of David. You have this classic, beautiful choral rendition by Randall Thomas on, you know, he who rules must you know, do so in the fear of God and so on. And then you've got 1 Kings chapter 2, where it's, as Robert Alter puts it, David's last words are worthy of a dying mafia capo, basically saying, you know, be strong, be a man, and by the way, kill these two men with whom I still have grudges, but who, you know, who I have spared so far. And Solomon does so. He kills Joab, and then he sort of sets up a house arrest condition with Shammai. And 3 years later, Shammai violates it, possibly misunderstanding that the stricture not to cross the brook of Kedron means don't come into Jerusalem. But so he goes elsewhere and comes back, and Solomon says, hey, sorry, broke the rules, you're dead. So you've got, you know, as I said, you've got this golden era of Israel and the two kings, David and Solomon, the two best-known kings, are both stumble. David at least stumbles relatively early and is trying to tries to recover, you know, pleads for mercy, or at least we have the Psalms and so on for that. Solomon, you know, asks God for wisdom, gets riches, gets, you know, fame, gets tremendous power. This is truly the golden age of the 12 tribes of Israel. But he fails to endure to the end. And this may actually be one of the reasons why that theme is so constant through the Book of Mormon. That the prophets, having seen the history of Israel and seen the tragedy, particularly of Solomon, may have kept saying, you know, you need to endure to the end. It's not enough to have God bless you. You've got to hang in there. And Solomon does not.
Yeah, and you have here some really interesting aspects that play into that with the characterizations of how Solomon and David have worked. So like you point out, the first couple chapters here in 1 Kings are kind of the culmination of what some scholars using historical and redaction critical methods have come to term the succession story, which is kind of an implicit source. As Martin mentioned, there are a number of sources that are mentioned explicitly in these books as for where they're drawing their histories from. Scholars have kind of, using specific critical methods, have isolated a number of other stories that make up the basis of this. One of them is the Ark story, how the Ark moves and then comes eventually to Jerusalem. The other is the rise of David triumphing over Saul. The third major one that they point to is what they call the succession narrative, which is kind of the clearing of the way for ultimately Solomon to be the king that succeeds, be the son of David that succeeds to the throne. And this, all the way from basically the latter half of 2 Samuel, goes forward with these all things and culminates then here with David advising Solomon to get rid of these other people who are major political players in the kingdom and could potentially stand in his way of taking over as king eventually, has been pointed out. And this, though, acts in a number of interesting ways to begin the story of Solomon. These first three chapters have some very negative characterizations of him. First of all, with this first one, casting him as a murderer, where he's slaughtering those who could potentially be what's the word?
Threats to the throne.
Threats to the throne or rivals in some possible ways. But then moving on, you have a number of other stories that will follow this up. And it becomes really interesting to compare then the agendas and the ways that they're beginning these characterizations of Solomon with the other historical record that we have in Chronicles, where the agenda is much different. So for instance, in Chronicles, there's a much more positive characterization of Solomon. It excludes certain facts about his rise to power, particularly this aspect of him having killed off his rivals. And he's noted as being a king without conflict. He's cast as a man of peace and unity, particularly that's probably a wordplay on what most scholars consider his throne name. We know him as Solomon, but probably that was not his birth name, as it is related. In Hebrew, it's Shlomo, which is particularly related in root to Shalom, peace. And so it's playing on this. He's approved by God. You can read about this in 1 Chronicles 22, particularly 8 through 10. And he accomplishes the job David set him out to do in building the temple. And that's the crux of the Chronicles narrative, that all of this, the theological agenda there is that the temple is built, has God's approval, and thus it establishes Solomon as the ideal righteous builder of the temple. And so as Bruce was pointing out, this is the golden age, or the golden era and age in Israel's relation to God. Coming back then to the king's account, the Deuteronomistic history has a different theological viewpoint that it's putting forward that is generally one of slow decline. So you go back to the original, whereas Solomon is cast as the major golden era of the Chronicles account, and in this sense, particularly here, can be seen as maybe a minor golden era. In the Deuteronomistic history, the golden era is Joshua, who comes in and has this conquest, which, looking at it from this lens, may not have actually happened the way it's portrayed in Joshua. It's an idealized past. They don't come in and slaughter everybody, but these people writing centuries later want to have this boost in what we would call nationalism and pride in their nations. But then the Deuteronomistic history steps forward, and as you move through Judges and Samuel all the way down to Kings, you have the slow decline of the nation that then comes to this point. And even though David and Solomon are held up as doing these amazing works with this unified kingdom, it's still not the idealized kingdom, the idealized unified tribes of Israel under Joshua. And although they build the temple, there are still issues. And this plays into the general theological agenda of the Deuteronomistic history and the historian who's putting it together. The history is meant as a theological accounting for the things that have occurred. And this is why a lot of the scholars see this as happening after the fall of the kingdom, because they're dealing with the issues. They have to understand, basically it's built into an idea taken from Deuteronomy that obedience, strict obedience to the law, the Deuteronomistic code that was mentioned as having been found by Josiah, obedience to that code will bring blessings and posterity, and any deviation from it will bring punishment. And they view their history through the lens of this promise from Deuteronomy, and therefore they tend to try and account for any problems in their history by trying to pinpoint the position of who sinned, who did something wrong. And in this case, this is written well after the fact of the split of the kingdoms. And therefore, from the Deuteronomistic position and viewpoint, theologically, somebody must have screwed up. Somebody must have done something extremely evil for the Lord to allow this unity to dissolve. That happens at the end of Solomon's reign when his son, Rehoboam, takes over. The major split in the kingdom occurs. And so they have this theological problem. How do you account for the evil of the fall of the unity of the kingdom, but still have these major, major players? And so part of the issue will be put upon the head of Solomon, particularly his apostasy that comes down at the end of his reign in his foreign exploits and marrying lots of women for treaties, etc. But this is also showing up in the beginning of the Solomon narratives in 1 Kings. So generally, Solomon's story is told in these first 11 chapters, from 1 Kings 1 through 1 Kings 11. But when you start to analyze those chapters, you see that 1 Kings 1 through 3 has somewhat of a very negative framing for Solomon. And then you get to some stories that have very positive aspects for him, from 3 or 4, depending on how you look at things, through his construction of the temple, through the visit of the Queen of Sheba, his palace, the dedication of the temple, etc., all the way through to chapter 10, the visit of the Queen of Sheba. And then in chapter 11, you have another major negative chapter portraying Solomon's many errors and his dramatic fall. So that this portion of the Deuteronomistic history then has these positive central stories about Solomon that are very important to the people, cannot be overlooked in the history, and have him very positively mentioned, but then places this frame around them negatively to predispose the readers of this history to understand that while Solomon did some great things, he's also very flawed. And this then is the story that comes out through Samuel and Kings, where Saul, David, and Solomon are all cast as very complex characters with very strong positive characteristics, but are ultimately negative characters, or at least they are not the ideal. And this comes then as part of this theological agenda, having to account for the issues that will come up in the splitting of the kingdom. But also it is important to recognize that the hero of the Deuteronomistic history is King Josiah, who will come at the end. And all kings previous to him are, they can have positive qualities, but they're ultimately flawed characters as compared to him. Thus, they are taking these previously written ideas and putting them in the context and historical understanding that makes them seem negative instead of positive. So, for instance, jumping into some of these things, you have these two types of narratives. We took one where it's very critical and it sets Solomon up as somewhat of a killer. But then you also have positions that look seemingly laudatory about King Solomon. So, for instance, you jump into chapter 3, where from our perspective, verse 1 says, Solomon made a marriage alliance with the Pharaoh, king of Egypt. He took Pharaoh's daughter and brought her into the city of David. So he marries the daughter of Pharaoh. And from our perspective, sometimes this is the beginning of stories that, depending on your viewpoint and perspective, can either be very negative or very positive. Today we may look at this and think to ourselves, that's a very positive thing. He's being very politically savvy. He's making peace. He's doing good things. But from the viewpoint of someone who is obsessed with the law of Deuteronomy, who is looking at these things, what is Egypt? Egypt is evil, with a capital E. Egypt is the evil empire, and thus he's making a marriage alliance. Does this support him as a wise and careful ruler? Maybe, maybe not. But then particularly as well from a literary perspective, this can be seen as foreshadowing for the issues that are to come at the end of his reign. This is the beginning of his snowball into problematic foreign alliances. Similarly as well, then you have the story in chapter 3, verses 3 through 15, where Solomon has this visit from the Lord, which from our perspective is absolutely positive. It's absolutely something that occurs. We can view it as such, where Solomon walks in the statues of David, he gives offerings, he gains wisdom, and these are all important things. But it seems like the person putting together this history wants to turn this on its head, and it notes specifically that the king goes to Gibeon to do so, and notes, verse 4, I'm reading from the NRSV because that's just what I have in front of me, the king went to Gibeon to sacrifice there. For that was the principal high place. Solomon used to offer 1,000 burnt offerings on that altar. And then it's at Gibeon that the Lord appears to him. So it has this heavy stress on Gibeon, which from our perspective, that just goes over our head because we just don't think about it. But then it notes in verse 15 that Solomon then comes back to Jerusalem where the ark is. And so from the perspective of a Deuteronomistic historian and the people in the context where they're playing this, this then becomes a problematic story. Solomon is going and offering sacrifice at a place that is not the authorized shrine. It is not in front of the ark. And he's gaining wisdom, power, and riches. This could be very positive, but if you're reading this from their perspective, it's an automatic negative. He's going to a Canaanite shrine. Why is he going there? What is going on? Why isn't he in front of the ark that is stated as being in Jerusalem? maybe to put it in our perspective, and this may be a little bit crass, but you know, consider it as, say, the prophet. Instead of going into the temple to gain revelation, heads down to the bar, or maybe even a gay bar, and gets revelation there. Not completely out of line, you know, maybe he could do it, but from the perspective of a believing and fully Orthodox Mormon, that doesn't really jive, and maybe has some issues with it. And so seen from that respect, definitely this chapter can be negative. And then his wisdom on display, you know, we always talk about Solomon's wisdom in judging between the two ladies with their children, trying to figure it out. Martin, you had one point on this that you wanted to share.
I did. One of the things that happens here is that we often talk about the wisdom of Solomon because he is so adept at determining who the actual mother is of the child, because he discerns that the actual mother would not want the child to die, and rather than dying, he'd rather have she would rather have the non-mother even keep the child, whereas the real mother would not. So he finds out who the mother is, but what's left out and not often emphasized as we discuss the story is that these two women are prostitutes, not exactly the greatest profession in our day, but it is not even mentioned with any negative kind of a statement. It's just very matter-of-factly presented here in Kings, whereas there are numerous other examples in the Old Testament of prostitutes certainly used in a very, very negative way in terms of how they're described. So that may very well say something about the morality that was going on in Jerusalem at the time, and would dovetail into what Bruce talked about earlier. You've got this golden age, but there are certainly some very ungolden-like things going on at the time.
Yeah, and fits into the general idea of this is a continual downward slide, where, you know, previous to this, this would have occasioned major discussion, but now it's just accepted out of course. Viewing this also from this position then as potentially being somewhat negative, you can see it both ways. You can see how these stories could be seen as positive, but you can also see how they're being framed somewhat negatively according to the understandings of the historical context in which it's originally being written and presented. In this case, you read that from this context, and the women seem very much, you know, as characterizations. They're just kind of going along. He says, let's chop it in half, and one of them really says, okay, yeah, get the sword, let's do it. It doesn't ring true to life in some senses there. And as such, you know, it can be seen to be sort of a negative aspect to it. And this then is continued in chapter 4, where it, you know, we don't normally get into this because it has all these ideas of administration, but it becomes clear that this positionality of Solomon, he's not the best ruler. He's divided the kingdom in two different ways, and it talks about he has 12 officials over all of Israel. Remember, Israel is the northern kingdom, but he only has one over Judah. And then it talks about all the people that he conscripts for his building projects and all the taxes he's taking from the northern kingdom. All of this is just foreshadowing for what's going to happen with Rehoboam, where Rehoboam comes in and says, hey, we're going to increase what the northern kingdom owns, and the northern kingdom says, no, we're out of here, and splits off. And so, again, this is kind of, you know, Solomon is supposed to be this great and mighty person, and he's going to be when he builds the temple, and he's going to be as he prays for the people. But it looks like, again, the Deuteronomistic history is taking these previous narratives and recasting them according to its own understandings theologically of what is supposed to go on, to cast him in a particular negative frame around this positive, so that you never really think about him extremely positively if you're reading with their lenses. And then they come back to this again, as mentioned, in chapter 11, with all of the wives and the Solomon chasing after the gods of other nations. So all in all, then, the end points to this theological agenda of the Deuteronomistic history, but it as needing to account for the issues and the problems there that unrighteousness as necessity brings punishment and woe. But ultimately, for our purposes, we can look at it this way and see that these are complex characters. They have their flaws. They're not to be idealized. They're not superhuman. Helps us look at Solomon as being extremely blessed. He is given this wisdom. He is given all these things, but ultimately, in some ways, he fails to live up to the responsibilities and the opportunities provided by those blessings. He's made king. He's given wisdom, but he continues to act maybe a little bit more unwise, which is, in general, the point of the whole lesson here. What's its title again? King Solomon, Man of Wisdom, Man of Foolishness. He's got both sides going on. And the whole point is, well, as applied to us, what blessings are we given? And how do we live up to those promises and blessings? What will our accounting be as we have held to our responsibilities as well as magnified the opportunities that we've been given? So that's kind of on the general aspect. Were there any specific verses that anybody wanted to jump into? Martin, I think you had some, and Bruce, you had some others.
We talked about the first one, and that was about the two women, the two prostitutes, and the child. And that's meant to show that Solomon has great wisdom. He's able to discern who the real mother is. We have two different descriptions here of the Lord appearing to Solomon in a dream. One of those is at the beginning of chapter 9. The first one is, of course, at the very beginning of our lesson here in chapter 3 and verses 5 through 9. You can't have someone who is horribly viewed, who is seeing God and who has God give him great blessings, as we see in chapter 3. And so there are a lot of different struggles about exactly how Kings is going to be viewed here. It seems in some ways to be kind of a dispassionate view of Solomon in that both the good and the bad are shown. But you have someone here who, according to King, is visited by God. That's not an ordinary occurrence, and that would show that he had God on his side. The other comments that I wanted to mention deal with the actual construction of the temple and its purpose, and so maybe we could defer that.
Yeah, maybe before we get to that, in connection with your idea that Solomon, this is not an unusual occurrence, but it's also important to recognize that in all those promises he gets, it is definitely a conditional promise, just like all of the promises made to us are conditional on how well we endure to the end, coming back to what Bruce mentioned earlier. So you look at 1 Kings 3:14, when the Lord's talking to him, if you will walk in my ways, keeping my statutes and my commandments as your father David walked, then I will lengthen out your life. He comes back to it in chapter 6, verses 11 through 13, concerning this house that you are building, if you will walk in my statutes, obey my ordinances, and keep all my commandments by walking in them, then I will establish my promise with you. I will dwell among the children of Israel, and I will not forsake my people. And then lastly, you come back to it again in chapter 9 with the second visit of the Lord. I have heard your prayers. I have consecrated the house. If you will walk before me, verse 4, if you will walk before me as David your father walked with integrity of heart and uprightness, doing according to all that I have commanded you, and keeping my statutes and my ordinances, then I will establish your royal throne over Israel forever, as I promised your father David, saying, there shall not fail you a successor on the throne of Israel. That's a lot of conditionals there, that the Lord, you know, promises him, hey, these things are yours for the having, but it's up to you to keep the things that keep to the covenants you have made and do those things that are stipulated in those covenants between us, and then I will bless you. Any other thoughts on anything?
The only thing I have to add there is Elder Neil A. Maxwell many years ago in a talk famously said, this life is a test, is a test, is a test. And then just stressed, I think from some of his own extremities towards the end of his life, that as long as we're alive, as long as we're down here, we can succeed or we can fail, and that poor choice or rash act can undo much good.
Right, and we can't ever forget the importance of repentance. We're all going to make mistakes. We're all going to fail in some sense. You bring up Elder Maxwell. It reminds me of one of my favorite quotes from him, where he talks about this, where we so blithely say that this life is a test, without really coming to understand the real ramifications of that. But it is going to be a test. It's not going to be easy. It says something like, we're not going to be able to succeed with one hand tied behind our backs. It's going to test us and try us very much, and in a way that we cannot mistake, that when those tests and trials come to you, you will recognize them because they will touch you intimately, deeply, and you won't mistake them for being something else. And that, I think, is something important to recognize as well, that, you know, sometimes there's not good answers to the things that we have to do in life, and we just need to accept with faith, have our faith strongly rooted in the Savior, in the covenants we make with him, and the powers of his atonement to help us overcome and stretch beyond those things that we're capable of. Which I think one of the more impacting sections of this lesson that comes to me is at the in Solomon's dedicatory prayer in chapter 8, verses 52 through 53. Again, the NRSV, I haven't looked at the KJV on this, it might sound a little bit different, but it says here, let your eyes be open to the plea of your servant and to the plea of your people Israel, listening to them whenever they call to you. For you have separated them from among all the peoples of the earth to be your heritage, just as you promised through Moses your servant when you brought our ancestors out of Egypt, O Lord God. This to me is an interesting one to read, for us to read in light of our own understandings of the temple, our own understanding of the covenants, where Israel has been created via separation from the peoples of the earth. You can go back to the Exodus, where the Lord is smiting Egypt and bringing out people through the separated waters, all of this to be a heritage or a legacy of the Lord. And we likewise, when we go to the temple, we can be recreated, further taking upon us the name of Christ to become a kingdom of priests, a holy nation unto God. We are set apart from the world and ordained to a greater work via those covenants. But again, they're conditional. In so much as we keep those covenants, we set ourselves up in a place where the Lord can see and hear our pleas whenever we call upon him. He puts us in somewhat of a privileged hotline, I guess, if you want to think about it that way. But when we are truly being faithful to him, he can hear our pleas and send us answers to our prayers. Well, did you want to talk for a couple minutes about the construction of the temple, Martin? I think our time is generally moving. I've probably talked too much. I'm sorry.
You're all good.
Absolutely, we're all good. A couple of quick comments. One is that there are some things that are really similar about Solomon's temple when compared with our LDS temples today. And there are some things that are very, very, very different. And we need to keep that in mind. We sometimes read through and think, oh, Solomon had a temple. Hey, you know, you could go back through there and wander through the front gate. And if you had your temple recommend, you know, you'd all be good. And you'd do a session and come out. It was definitely not like that. These were very different temples from, this was a very different temple than the temples that we have today are. If you look at the dedication of the temple in chapter 8, starting in verse 62, it talks, of course, about all the animal sacrifices that took place there. That's, of course, one great difference foreshadowing, from our perspective, the atonement of Christ, after which sacrifices ended. But there are other differences as well. For example, in verse 31 of chapter 8, it has a description of a person who's accused of wrongdoing, and he's brought to the altar of the temple to take an oath that he's innocent. That's not the kind of a practice that we would find in our temples today.
The altars in our temples are very different than the altar in Solomon's temple.
Absolutely.
Form, function, and everything.
Exactly. And so we need to realize the difference of the temples and the different purposes. But there are similarities as well. The construction was of the very, very finest materials, as we would read in chapter 6. Our temples are also constructed of the very finest things. Our temples today and also Solomon's temple were viewed as the place on earth where people could communicate directly with God, and that God could come and, if not personally dwell, at least visit, which brings me to one last quick little point that I'd like to make, which is in chapter 8, verse 27, where it said that the heavens cannot contain thee, referring to God. Seems that Solomon has a slightly different concept of God than we might today. We don't know exactly how he viewed him, but we do know that he saw God as a personal God and close to him, but he might not have had the exact same view of God, just as the temples then were not exactly like our temples are today. So, you know what, I'll leave it there sort of with a short few little comparisons and contrasts.
Just to add one additional point to that, Martin, I think your point about the temple and it's how differently it functioned is critical. We have a propensity in the church to try and retroactively impose current practices and ordinances on other dispensations, and there's clearly evidence for that in some dispensations, but in others there is not. I joined at age 14, and it was common in talking about the Old Testament to assume that the molten sea outside the temple was used for baptisms. And that you had practice of baptism. Well, you do have ritual purification as a Jewish practice, but I don't know that it was ever done in the molten sea, and it was not baptism in the way we think of as baptism. And you know, the much as again that just goes hand in hand with what you pointed out is that there you have the symbols. You've got, you know, you do have the ark there. You've got, at least, you know, with the tabernacle, you've got showbread, you've got a veil, you've got things that we see matches with our current temple, but the way things were practiced there and what the actual ordinances there are quite different. And you know, on top of that, it's a reminder that Israel was operating under a lesser law. They had a lesser law of ordinances and of practices, and a schoolmaster, or as I understand the Greek, is actually better translated as a babysitter, to keep them, to try and keep them on a straight and narrow. I might note, with not a lot of success. I marvel at God's patience with Israel.
Yeah, and in some ways we can marvel at his patience with us. Because well, even though we have a higher law, how often do we fail? How often do we, you know? And
anyway, so that's the only thing I wanted to add there, just as a coda to Martin's comment.
Yeah, no, it's an important aspect to remember that, you know, it's hard to judge from our current perspective, and we need to be able to set aside, in some ways, our lenses of how to view things. I hope that discussing all those stories at the beginning, you know, were from our perspective, but they look like they could be positive things. They look like it could be great. But from the perspective of the original historical aspect, they might not have been so good. And we need to keep that in mind and be very careful in the way that we utilize these scriptures. That doesn't mean that we can't use them for our own edification and understanding, but we need to be able to understand them outside of some of the contexts that we all stand in order to get at what they meant then, so that we can properly apply them in our lives today and avoid aspects of presentism, the casting back on former ages, those things that we practice now, and you know, looking for, you know, word of wisdom in ancient temple practice when it's not going to be there.
Yep.
Because that's a law for us today. It wasn't the law for them then. But, well, if anybody else has anything, if not...
I have one quick comment, and that is that in Chapter 9, in verses 6, 7, and 8, we have an absolute provable prophecy from the Old Testament that would have been considered quite quite amazing, that was literally fulfilled, where Solomon is told by God that if you or your descendants stop following me, and the temple will... And I'm reading from the Good News Bible here in verse 8. This temple will become a pile of ruins, is the way it's described here. When people saw Solomon's temple, they were in awe of it, and many of the stones weighed tons, many, many tons. And so to say that it would become a pile of ruins would be an incredible statement, especially in a time when there were not... machines and some of the mechanical devices that we have today, but literally in 68 AD and 70 AD, you know, when the Romans appeared, as is mentioned here, and as Jesus also prophesied just a few short years earlier, the temple would be destroyed, and indeed it was, and the Jews still to this day lament the loss of the temple that was foretold right here in Chapter 8, many, many centuries before.
Right. Yep, one way of looking at it. So let's then say thank you to our participants. Thank you to the listeners. And we point you to MormonInterpreter.com for more articles, roundtables, and other aspects dealing with Mormon scripture.